Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening. South Dakota Public Broadcasting reporter Jennifer Jones is with us today from Webster, but last month, for the entire month of December, she was in Greece working as a volunteer with refugees. She takes a break from legislative coverage to join Midday today. Jennifer Jones, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you.
So let's start by telling us how you ended up in Greece and where exactly you were at.
All right. Well, my heart had been breaking for months and months just watching the news about the refugee crisis happening there. And so when I saw that an organization called Adventures and Missions that I had previously done a trip with was taking trips to go to Greece and work in camps there, I immediately said, yes, please, can I go? I was on the island of Lesbos, where thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of refugees came across that island in 2015. And for, I think, about 5 years now, the crisis has actually been going on their way to get into Greece to go to other parts of Europe.
So put me on that island right now. How big is it? What can you see? Can you see across to other places? Where is it geographically?
Well, it's very close to Turkey. Some spots on the island are just about 5 miles across the Aegean Sea from Turkey, and that's why a lot of refugees are coming to this island, because it's about an hour and a half boat ride in some places from the shores of Turkey to get onto the beaches of Lesbos. It is, however, an extremely dangerous journey in unsafe boats, overcrowded boats. The island itself is actually pretty large. I don't, can't give you exact mileage, but from the point that we were at working at this camp to the camp that the refugees ultimately would have to end up at so they could register, it was about an hour, hour and a half drive away. So the island itself is fairly large.
So refugee becomes a fairly generic term at some point. I'm sure you want to put a face to those individuals. So tell me who these people are. Where are they coming from? Where are they hoping to get to?
Absolutely. So, saying refugee and calling them refugees, I kind of almost hated to do that after a while, because it makes it sound like, in some cases a political idea or just kind of this faceless, massive group of people. But one of the most powerful thing for me initially was our first night working at the camp, when I actually got to see, these refugees firsthand. And you look and you see, their mothers and fathers and children and brothers and sisters, and it could easily be you or I in this position. On this, the people that I interacted with specifically, most are still from Syria. I was told about 50% came from Syria, about 20% from Afghanistan, and 30% from other countries. I interacted with mostly people from Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq, if I'm recalling that correctly, and they are people just like you or I, that have been forced from their homes because of the incredible amount of violence happening in those nations currently.
Where are they trying to get to?
Most seem to be trying to get to Germany. Germany had an open border policy. I've been reading in the news that that's come under some scrutiny, that some people are now wanting Germany to close its borders. But most seem to be wanting to get to Germany. That seems to be a sort of a promised land for many of these refugees.
And what condition are they arriving in? How are they getting across the water?
Okay. So smugglers are putting them into boats, and it's actually quite expensive. One day, I believe the boat ticket was going for about $1,300, I was told. So smugglers are putting them in either these rubber boats, overcrowded, maybe about 50 people in one of these boats, or they're putting them into wooden boats that have been decommissioned that should not be on the sea anymore, rotting wood. And, you know, there might be a couple hundred refugees in those boats at any given time. The journey from where our camp was to Turkey, we could see Turkey across the water there, might take about an hour and a half, depending on the day. Extremely dangerous. One evening, I was speaking to a man from Afghanistan, and he was pretty shooken up. The other refugees he came with were pretty shooken up as well. He was telling me how on the sea, the waves were like mountains. He came over during the night, and everyone was terrified, and their boat had started to sink, and they called for help, and no one would help them. And there were times that people came into our camp soaking wet, children soaking wet. So part of our job was to give them dry clothes and dry socks and dry shoes, especially if it continued to get deeper into winter here. People were cold, and when you add the freezing water and that long boat ride into it, there were some people who were arriving at camp in pretty rough shape, particularly children at times.
What were some of your frustrations, I'm wondering, with, you know, as an American over there in those circumstances, what frustrated you about the whole process?
Well, I sort of got a little obsessed with the clothing tent at times because it was like clothing is a tangible thing. You know, I felt like, okay, if I could put dry socks on this person's feet, then maybe I made a difference that day. It was just something tangible. And often it felt like we didn't have the supplies that we needed. We never seemed to have enough socks, and we certainly never seemed to have enough adult shoes. And so we had to tell people, you know, that we didn't have the things that they needed quite frequently. And that was frustrating to me, especially, you know, in my daily life. If I need something, I can just go get it. But not having the ability to just go get the things that I needed for these people, that was frustrating at times.
Now, you're a journalist, but you were not volunteering as a journalist. You're volunteering just as hands and feet on the ground. What is the perception of journalists covering this crisis and telling this story?
That was a big surprise for me, was to learn that journalists are not well-liked on this island. I heard some despicable stories, actually, about things that journalists had done. Doctors would tell me how they were trying to give, you know, CPR to people who had just landed on the island and were, you know, suffering from hypothermia and other things, and journalists would be in their faces with cameras. I heard one story about a journalist taking a child from the beach, plunking it in the water, and then putting it back on the beach so that they could get their crying baby shot. So, yeah, it was insane and awful, just awful, some of the stories that I heard. It made me really think to myself about how, if I were there in a journalist capacity, you know, how would I tell the story? What is an ethical way to get the information that you need and tell the important stories while also respecting the aid workers and respecting the refugees themselves and not seeing them as just a story but actual people? So it really got me thinking about journalism ethics, for
right.
sure.
And did those people, to your you know, overall perception, did they come wanting their story to be told? Did they come wanting to tell their story in an appropriate way, or did they just really not want to talk, and were they in survival mode?
Well, probably a combination of both. I did get to have a lot of great conversations with the people at camp, but I think it's like anything else. There were people who wanted to talk, a lot of people anxious to practice their English, but then there were also people who, you know, were probably just needed to rest after that extremely extremely difficult and terrifying boat ride. So like anything else, like any other, you know, people you'd meet, there's a combination of people who want to talk and people who were more reserved.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were in the camp mostly, or did you go down and help rescue people as they're coming out of the water?
We were in the camp mostly. Our camp was stage two camp. So the stage one camps are on the beach, and they're the ones that have all the emergency response people who, you know, are there, so when they see a boat on the water, they can go and they can help bring it in safely and stabilize it and take care of the people right away. And then the people were put into vans and driven up the hill to our camp. And at our camp, we had doctors there as well, and we'd welcome them. They would get blankets and some food and water, and then given a bus ticket. And the reason why that was important is because before the camps were set up, and the camps really haven't been around all that long, but before they were set up, it was a two-day walk for people when they arrived on our side of the island to the place on the island that they need to go to register so that they can move on to Athens and where they want to go. And so our camp allowed people to get on a bus and drive on a bus for an hour and a half and be at that camp instead of walking for 2 days. However, there were a couple times that I was on the beach when boats came in. One day, New Year's Day in particular, was a crazy day. A group of us ended up on the beach. We had intended to drive down the hill to go to church, but we ended up driving to the beach instead when we saw that a boat was coming in, and there were a lot of kids and babies on this boat, and the rescue workers were just putting them into, you know, whoever available arms, and a rescue worker yelled, "Baby!" And I stuck out my hands, and then all of a sudden there's this tiny, freezing, wet little baby in my arms.
And then what happened? begs to say, what's next? So you're standing there on the beach, you're miles away from home, and you're holding a suffering, wet child. How does that impact you, and what do you do next?
Well, I tell you, I don't know that I've ever felt so helpless in my life. This baby was barely responding. He had spit up all over his face, and so first thing, I went to the guy handing out the tinfoil emergency blankets, and so took off the life jacket and put on the emergency blanket. And then I just held this baby, and I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed, and I prayed, because, like I said, I there was nothing I could do really in that moment. Other than that, I was standing next to one of my teammates who was holding another baby who was screaming, and she was singing to this little guy. And then one of the women who'd been on the boats, she was quite frantic, and she kept looking at my baby and my teammate's kiddo. And what we realized later was that, or what I realized later was that these were her children, and she was frantic because she was looking for her third, and her third child had been placed in a car already, and so her third kiddo was fine, but she didn't know that quite yet. And my teammate looked at me and said, "We've got these two." And what she meant was, you know, we need to stick together so that these two kids aren't separated. But what I took it to mean in that moment was, okay, there's this beach full of you know, wet, freezing people. But in this moment, you know, all we can do is take care of these two kids that we've been entrusted with. So eventually, the doctor or an emergency responder there came and looked at my baby and, you know, said, "Okay, we need to get this one in the car up the hill right away." And so they did that, and we walked back to the car. We went back up the hill and began the process of taking care of all these wet, cold kiddos. Basically, with all hands on deck that day, everyone in the clothing tent trying to find the dry baby clothes and baby blankets. And they put my kiddo in a corner of the big tent by the heater, and all the volunteers that were working on this kiddo, everyone's eyes were wet. You know, you could kind of tell that it was just a very emotional moment. But of course, you know, you have to keep it together because that's what needs to happen in that moment. So eventually, The doctors looked at my kiddo, and he got warm, and everything was fine. I got to hold him a little while later that afternoon, and I was holding him, and he was asleep, and I told him, you know, you are so loved, I whispered, and he smiled in his sleep, so that was a sweet moment. I found one of the Greek volunteers who was there with Samaritan's Purse, and I said, I just need a hug, Gabriel. I said, today's one of those days I need a hug, and he gave me a hug, and he said, you know, what these people need now is smiling, you know, welcoming faces. And he said, tonight around the campfire, that's when we cry. And I said, okay. And so you just kind of, you hold it together, and then you think about it later. But
how do you process it later? If you can hold it together at that moment, how do you come back to America and process this experience?
I think in some ways I'm still processing, and I'll still, you know, maybe be working through that. One of the hardest things for me at our camp was the fact that, you know, these people might be at our camp for an hour, 2 hours, depending on the day. And, you know, you hang out with them and you build this small relationship with them, and then they get put on a bus and they go somewhere else. And people have asked me, you know, do you know what happened to that baby? And I said, I don't. And I probably will never know, unless by some miracle, you know, something happens where I get to hear the rest of that story. But I don't. I mean, when that baby and his family left the camp, everyone was fine. Everyone was healthy and okay. But they have a long road ahead of them. They may still be in Athens waiting to move on, you know, with borders opening and closing, and now it's winter time. And so maybe that baby's fine, and maybe he's not. You know, maybe he and his family are freezing cold somewhere, and I can't do anything about that. And so processing through that is kind of difficult, especially, you know, when I'm sitting very warm and very comfortable in my apartment right now, and trying to figure out how to be okay with the fact that I'm warm and comfortable in my apartment living my normal American life, while this family and countless of other families are really struggling right now. Figuring out how to be okay with that is an ongoing process.
Jennifer Jones, thank you for telling us just this small part of a very big story. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Jennifer Jones. She's a South Dakota Public Broadcasting reporter who spent the month of December 2015 volunteering with refugees in Greece. We're going to take a short break. What you need to know about supplements and safety is ahead, a special Frontline Investigations tonight. Stick around. I'm Lori Walsh. You're listening to Dakota Midday on SDPB Radio.